listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Vermont author Mark Pendergrast, whose latest book is Japan's Tipping Point, Crucial Choices in the Post-Fukushima World. Mark Pendergrast was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, the fourth of seven children in a family that valued civil rights, the environment, sailing, reading, and games of chase and charades. He earned a BA in English literature from Harvard, taught high school and elementary school, and then went back to Simmons College for a master's in library science. He then worked as an academic librarian, all the while writing freelance articles for newspapers and magazines. In 1991, he began writing books full-time, and that allows him to follow his rather eclectic interests. Mark Pendergrast's books have been published in 15 languages. His book, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, was named a notable book of the year by the New York Times. And Discover magazine chose his book, Mirror, Mirror, as one of the top science books of the year. Pendergrast has given speeches to professional groups, business associations, and college audiences in the United States, Canada, the UK, and Germany. He has appeared on dozens of television shows, including The Today Show, CBS This Morning, and CNN, and has been interviewed on over 100 radio programs, including All Things Considered, Marketplace, and many other public radio shows. He was last on this show in 2010 to speak about his book, Inside the Outbreaks, The Elite Medical Detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service. He lives in Colchester. I spoke to Mark Pendergrast last week, and I asked him to begin by speaking about his decision to go to Japan and research renewable energy in 2011. His trip had been scheduled for not long after the earthquake and tsunami, which caused the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster.
I belong to the National Association of Science Writers.
Uh-huh.
And they sent a flyer about a grant called from the Abe Foundation, which is a Japanese organization, and it offered a six-week trip to Japan to research some aspect of science.
Okay.
And at the time, I was trying to write a book called 2084, or trying to get a contract for a book called 2084. Sort of like Orwell's, 1984,
right,
but 100 years later, focused on climate change, running out of fossil fuel, and too many people, which is a book that I would very much still like to write, but I can't get a contract for it, so I've been trying to get a grant.
Okay.
So here this opportunity came, and I thought to myself, Japan is an island country with virtually no fossil fuel. They're technologically advanced. They must be doing some interesting things with renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I can find something like that. So I spent about 15 minutes Googling, and I came up with a program called the Eco Model Cities Program.
Uh-huh.
That Japan had instituted in 2008. And there were 13 cities around Japan that were doing innovative things with renewable energy and conservation and things like that. So in the fall of 2010, I applied for this grant, and I basically said, okay, 6 weeks. I go spend the first week in Tokyo talking to government people and getting my feet on the ground, and then I'll spend 1 week each in four of these different cities, and then I'll come back and wrap up in Tokyo. And I was basically, I had some ideas, and I had actually contacted a guy named Tetsunari Iida at the Institute for Sustainable Energy Practices in Tokyo.
Uh-huh.
I found him on the web, too, and he said, sure, yeah, we can help you. Maybe we can set you up in our offices over here. So with that background, I got the grant. I then found a relatively inexpensive airfare,
uh-huh,
and I bought a ticket, probably around January of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And then in March, on March the 11th, 2011, this gigantic earthquake hit Japan,
right,
followed by a tsunami. And as we all know, it damaged the Fukushima nuclear reactor severely, and it caused radioactive leaks, and it shut down. And following that, the United States government was advising people not to go to Japan unless they absolutely had to.
Uh-huh.
And many people were leaving Japan. So I wasn't sure whether I was going to go or not. My ticket was for May the 10th, and I was supposed to arrive in Tokyo on May the 11th, which was exactly 2 months after the tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
And the nuclear accident. So it wasn't clear to me whether I would end up going, but by the middle or late April, things looked like they'd calmed down. The radioactivity they'd found in the water in Tokyo had lessened to a safe degree, everybody was saying, so I thought, okay, I'll go. And I did. So that's how I ended up going to Japan, arriving on May the 11th, 2011.
Okay. Did you see today's paper mentions that Japan had thought about evacuating Tokyo? Have you heard all about that at all?
I knew that it was under consideration in the days following the meltdown.
Yeah.
So it was really a very tense time.
Yeah.
And I arrived, so fortuitously, in a way, suddenly the subject of my research, renewable energy in Japan, became a vital concern. It was really much more timely than I ever thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it was very clear that, you know, up until then, the Japanese had planned to build another 14 nuclear reactors. And they were going to get half of their electricity from nuclear power. Suddenly, that wasn't going to happen anymore. And, in fact, the entire future of nuclear power in Japan was in question. So what were they going to do? They certainly did not want to use more fossil fuel, both because it was going to contribute more to global warming, and because it was going to become increasingly expensive in the coming years.
Mm-hmm.
So what were they going to do? Well, clearly they should be doing more with renewable energy. But when I got over there, I discovered that Japan is in some ways even worse than the United States in terms of its politics. They have had six prime ministers within 5 years.
Right.
The prime minister that was there at the time was named Kan, Prime Minister Kan, K-A-N, and he suddenly became a born-again advocate for renewable energy following the Fukushima disaster, but the bureaucrats in the Ministry for Economy, Trade, and Industry, which sort of runs the country, didn't like him. And he was eventually forced to announce his resignation.
Uh-huh.
So it was a disastrous situation. I also discovered that the Eco Model Cities program, which I had gone over to investigate,
yeah,
was largely a sham. They had set it up, the former prime minister had set it up in 2008 because they were going to have a G8 summit on mm-hmm. climate change that year, and he wanted something to announce. So with great, you know, pomp and circumstance, they announced the choosing of these 13 cities. But then the economy dropped out of, you know, in the end of 2008 everywhere in the world, including Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so they never gave them any money for these programs. So I did find some very interesting programs that various cities that I visited were doing, but by and large, they were piecemeal. They were too little, too late, and there was no national program in place. I ended up interviewing experts in Japan on every kind of renewable energy you can imagine, from geothermal to solar to wind to hydropower. And I discovered that they really were behind even the United States and China in terms of what they were doing for renewable energy. So that's why I ended up writing this book, Japan's Tipping Point, when I got home in a big hurry, because I thought, you know, I actually know more about this probably than virtually anyone in the world at this point as to what is going on in Japan. And it also occurred to me that they were, I call Japan the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world, because it's very clear that we're all going to be facing these same issues, but they are facing it more urgently and earlier than the rest of us, because they're an island country. Suddenly they're not going to be able to use nuclear power. What are they going to do?
I'm curious, how were you able to set up appointments and make contacts when you were going? Was this a new destination to you? Did you know anyone over there?
I had never been to Japan before. Fortunately, the Abe Fellowship is run by the Social Sciences Research Council in New York, and we had a retreat in Florida where I met some other people who had been in the program before, and it was, you know, to help you get ready to go over there. This was before the, this was in January of 2011. And so they had, through that meeting, I found a woman named Chiaki Kitada. I ended up doing a lot of Skype conversations with her for months before I went over there. Chiaki lives in Tokyo. She is a former journalist. She had worked for the Los Angeles Times in Japan as their correspondent. And she had helped former Abe fellows with their projects. So Chiaki ended up just being wonderful. She not only served as my interpreter while I was there, but she helped to set up all the appointments. She was vitally interested in the subject herself, and I ended up dedicating the book to her.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was great. Well, now, one of your first meetings was with Iida, who you already mentioned, Tetsunari Iida. And you describe him as the chief gadfly of nuclear power in Japan. And he's apparently currently something of a celebrity there because of his activism. So I was wondering if you could talk about your meetings with him.
Well, it was interesting. You know, he said, oh, sure, come on over. You can, you know, I'll meet with you and you can use my office. And I, the first meeting I had with him was canceled because he had a mysterious high-level meeting, perhaps with Khan, I don't know, but I couldn't meet with him that day. The only way I ended up meeting with him twice was to go to conferences where he was speaking and then take him out to dinner after one of them. He's unassuming, direct, dynamic. He's a former nuclear engineer himself who had become disenchanted with the industry and had been sort of a voice crying in the wilderness against nuclear power and in favor of renewable energy for years before the Fukushima disaster. But nobody paid that much attention to him. Suddenly, in the wake of it, he became the darling of the media. He was being summoned to meetings with government figures. He was manipulating things behind the scenes, and he was a very busy guy. So it was difficult to find him, but I did.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he's an interesting character.
Now, did your meetings with him direct sort of where you went next, or did you already have your full itinerary figured out before that?
No, I had it figured out before that.
Okay. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about TEPCO, which is Japan's largest utility, and you talk about how it's famous for having mishandled the Fukushima reactor meltdown.
Well, they not only mishandled that, they've been mishandling and obfuscating and hiding nuclear accidents for years. All of the utilities have problems in Japan, but TEPCO is the worst. You know, they have a weird system over there. It makes me feel wonderful about Vermont, and its utilities look great in comparison.
Really?
Yeah, they have a monopoly system over there that the good old U.S. occupation forces set up after World War II. There are 10 of them across the country, and they don't cooperate with each other. And as I said, it's a monopoly. So not only that, but half of the country is on 50 hertz, and half of the country is on 60 hertz. So they can't even send electricity easily around the country between those two sections. It's a disastrous setup, and it's going to cost billions of dollars to fix it if they ever get the courage to do so.
Okay. What did TEPCO do exactly to mishandle the crisis, in your opinion?
Well, they tried to minimize it in the first place. They took a long time to go and really seriously deal with it. And then the people that they sent in, God knows what's going to happen to them in future years.
Yeah.
But my book is not primarily about nuclear power.
No, it's not. No, I know.
I basically took it as a given that because of the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster, they were going to have to seriously look at renewable energy, and they are. It looks like they finally. Khan said that he would resign only if the legislature finally passed decent feed-in tariff for renewable energy, and they did, and it's supposed to go into effect this coming summer in July. But it remains to be seen whether it will actually have a major impact, whether TEPCO and METI, the ministry that's sort of in league with them, will fight it. And what impact it will have. You know, one of the things I discovered was that in 2005, Japan had about half of the solar energy capacity manufacturing in the world. But they then, and they had at least some kind of subsidy for solar panels in 2005, and then they cut it. And they didn't bring it back until 2009, and when they did, that was the only thing that they had a subsidy for, nothing for any other form of renewable energy. So they lost world leadership down to about 10% of the business by 2009, so they're scrambling to catch up.
I was going to ask you about what the intention of the Eco Model Cities program was when they first introduced it, and you know, what they claimed that it would do.
The idea of the Eco Model Cities program, which is a good one, is that you can't do everything from the top down, that a lot of initiatives can come from individual cities doing something, providing a model for others in the country and in the world for what might be done. And the federal government in Japan was going to support that. They ended up not supporting it very much, as I said, but it did create some very interesting programs or encouraged cities that were already doing good things. Like the first city I went to is called Kitakyushu. It's in the southern part of Japan. It's on the island of Kyushu. And it used to be the most polluted city in Japan. It was their equivalent of Pittsburgh, big steel city. Nippon Steel is based there. And I was really interested in learning the history there. The women of the steel mill workers, back in the 1960s, they had had it. They couldn't even see the sky. So they made a documentary using, you know, handheld Super 8 cameras called Give Us Our Blue Skies Back, or something like that.
Right.
And that was the beginning of the environmental movement in Japan. And they have now cleaned up Kitakyushu. It has become sort of a poster child for a formerly terribly polluted place. Their bay, fish died in it. It was called the Sea of Death. And now it's, you know, you can actually swim in it. So they have done a number of innovative and interesting things there. One of the things they did was to set up a whole recycling section for taking apart old appliances, for recycling bottles and plastic, and for recycling vegetables into compost and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on a landfill. They've also set up a number of wind turbines out there on that same landfill island. Also, because the steel industry, as a side product, produces hydrogen, they pioneered in the use of hydrogen fuel cells in a series of apartments. They let me ride a little bicycle that was powered by hydrogen.
So what does that mean, it's powered by hydrogen? Is it like there's a little motor that's powered by hydrogen on that bicycle?
Well, the motor is powered by a fuel cell, which is hydrogen uses a fuel cell, which it's rather complicated, and I'm not going to go into it here, but let me just say
I guess what I mean is because usually a bicycle you pedal. So is it more like a moped?
It's like an electric bicycle. It's a power assist. You can pedal it, but you can also get it to go on its own.
Okay.
But it's stupid. It's incredibly expensive. And it was just a toy that they did to try to show that they could do it, basically.
Yeah.
But no one's ever going to use one of these things. I am not a proponent of hydrogen power. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's extremely expensive. The only way they can do it is because it happens to be a byproduct of an industrial process. I talked to another guy who is a big hydrogen proponent who says, what Japan should do is pay for huge windmills in Argentina, which will then, using that renewable energy, you can then separate water into oxygen and hydrogen. Then you can have gigantic super tankers bring hydrogen over to Japan, and that's what you're going to use. Well, it's a tremendous waste of energy to do all of that, and I don't think it's ever going to happen. So that was the sort, the Japanese, they are in love with big techno fixes, mm-hmm. which aren't necessarily going to work. And another plan is to throw gigantic solar arrays up into space, and then to shoot laser beams down with energy from that. And again, I don't think that's ever going to happen, and if it did, it would be rather terrifying.
One of the things that you mentioned about Kita Kyushu was that they've helped other cities in the world to clean up their own pollution and recycle their products.
Right, and I think that's
right.
It's a good idea. They particularly are interested in helping China to clean up their cities, and the idea is that they can, number one, make money while they're doing this,
mm-hmm.
and number two, spread their technology elsewhere to try to save energy and to promote various forms of renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kita Kyushu is, they do have electric bicycles, not hydrogen ones, underneath panels of solar photovoltaic panels, and so you can go and rent a bicycle from one of these places, tool around the city, leave it at another place, and it makes sense. They're doing this other places in the world too. They're doing it in Montreal, but just with regular bikes, I think.
Yeah. So these are like little recharging stations where you pick it up or leave it off.
Yes.
Okay.
And you can go and get a new battery when yours is run out, things like that. And it's all recharged through solar energy.
Okay. Now, I was surprised to read in your book that Kita Kyushu was supposed to be the city on which the atom bomb would be dropped, and then they changed at the last minute to Nagasaki.
That's right. It would have been more logical at the time during World War II. Kita Kyushu was this huge industrial city. So they were going to drop the bomb there, but there was too much cloud cover, so they flew a little further away and dropped it on Nagasaki instead.
Hmm. Okay, so Kita Kyushu was the first city you went to. Where did you go after that?
I went to a complete contrast after that. I went to Yusahara, which is a little tiny town on the island of Shikoku, which is to the east of the main island in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the equivalent of, in a way, going to the Northeast Kingdom. It's just really beautiful. surrounded by mountains. I was quite taken by it, and the people were very friendly, and mm-hmm. it was a great place. And they also are doing some very interesting things. Of course, they're getting most of their renewable energy from big hydro dams, which were built back in the 60s, mm-hmm. and which, you know, you can't do any more of, basically. All of it's been done. And some of what they've done seems completely insane to me there also. There was one where they had... They went and showed me a hydro dam where I couldn't. There was no dam. I mean, you could see the power station. Mm-hmm. But I said, "Well, where's the dam? Where's the water coming from?" Well, the water was coming through a tunnel through the mountain from another river being dumped into this river. So the other river, which I eventually visited, was dried up below it. And, you know, the people who used to farm there and fish there were just out of luck. So it was kind of a nutty way to do things. But, you know, I was impressed with a lot of things they did. They had a town hall that was built by a very famous architect in Japan that used solar panels and natural convection of air to heat in the winter and to cool in the summer. They use geothermal heat for a swimming pool and a big hotel. So they were doing a number of interesting things. My favorite thing that they do is that about half of the toilets in Yusuhara still are just composting toilets.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're non-flush.
Oh, I remember this, yeah.
They go around and they collect all of the human waste, and they have a factory where they turn it into compost and
uh-huh.
then sell it to people just the same way we would buy compost here. So that was quite impressive.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I found that was totally stupid there that they're doing all over the country is wood pellet factories. Here, wood pellets might make some sense, because we have a large lumber industry, and we produce a lot of sawdust
mm-hmm.
that you can then compress. Well, in Japan, it turns out, after World War II, they decided to grow lots and lots of Japanese cedar
mm-hmm.
because it's quick-growing, and they thought that they could use it for their lumber industry. But it never happened because imported lumber from both the United States and Europe and eventually China, it was much cheaper. So they have this monoculture of these tall, spindly cedar trees that are kind of pretty, but they realize that they need to get rid of them or do mm-hmm. something with them. So the national government subsidized about 100 different wood pellet factories around the country. One of them is in Yusuhara. And what they do is bring the trees down from the mountain, and then they chip them, and then they turn the chips into sawdust, and then they compress the sawdust. So you can imagine what an incredible waste of fossil fuel it is to do all that.
Right, right.
Then nobody uses the wood pellets because
right.
The wood pellet stoves are quite expensive. The problem is that these wood pellet factories, they're not running at capacity because there's not a large market. The only places that are really using them are nursing homes or large schools or larger facilities. People don't use them in their homes. Like right there in Yusuhara, everybody said, well, you know, the wood stoves cost too much. They take up too much room in our small homes, and it's not what we want to do. So one of the things I suggested in the book was, why don't they build a small, very small wood stove to use the cedar, period. You don't need to go through all this. Just cut the cedar down, split it up. It splits very easily. It's not a hard wood, but if it's dried, it smells wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It provides good heat. It lights quickly. And particularly for older people who are around all day, it could provide a very simple way to heat your home with renewable energy, wood. instead, they're going through this huge expense to make wood pellets that no one is using.
So they just sit in factories after they're made? They just sit somewhere? Or?
Well, they don't make, they only make as many as they can sell.
Oh, okay.
So the factories aren't running all the time. They run at half capacity. And yes, they have a large supply of them sitting around.
Huh. So they have like all this technology and they've invested all kinds of money in creating this technology that they're not using.
That's right, because the federal government, NETI, the bureaucracy I mentioned, subsidized it, but it makes no sense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I found interesting about the Japanese cedars was that apparently in Tokyo, the pollen allergies are very bad, and so a lot of people are walking around with masks on to keep themselves from having allergic reactions to the cedar pollen.
That's exactly right. That's another result of the monoculture of cedar that mm-hmm. they promoted. And one of the, you know, one of the most touching parts of my visit was in Yusahara. I had actually seen a video that was made 20 years ago about a family named Matsumoto in Yusahara.
Mm-hmm.
And the plot of it basically was that the 15-year-old son was he or was he not going to take over the family farm.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they were doing was planting cedar trees. Cedar seedlings, because they were supposed to make so much money from this.
Mm.
So here I come 20 years later, and what has happened? The father is 68, a wonderful couple, he and his wife. I have pictures of them in the book. The son did not end up coming back to the family farm. He did go and get a degree in agriculture, but now he's an agricultural bureaucrat living about an hour away. And it's not clear what's going to happen to this absolutely beautiful farm and its rice paddies and its vegetable gardens and its ranks of cedar trees. It was a very sad sort of thing that a lot of people who are lamenting the loss of the family farm here in Vermont could identify with.
Sure, yeah.
Like there were a lot of similarities between Yusahara and Vermont.
And I think, was Yusahara where you found that they had therapy trails set up, nature walks?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's fun, it's a funny name for it, but they call them therapy trails where the idea is that you go and get back in touch with nature. And, you know, it's a sad thing that in most of Japan, the kids, you know, Japan, it's ironic. They have these beautiful Zen gardens, and they truly are just lovely.
Mm-hmm.
But they have cemented their rivers. They have cemented everything. So in a way, they've tried to control nature, supposedly to prevent erosion. Even in Yusahara, they had cement waffles going up their hillsides to supposedly prevent erosion. So in Tokyo, they have classes where they take children out to the forest because they've never seen a forest before for a field trip for one day. This is their big outing. It's a fascinating culture, but it was in many ways very disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned certain things like the huge screen TVs that you could see at your hotel windows when you were in the bigger cities and the sound pollution. It does sound like that aspect of the technology is a real drawback from the point of view of a tourist who's not excited about it.
Well, and it's a waste of energy. I mean, I talked about the pachinko parlors. I threw up I took a bunch of little videos with my digital camera where I was there, and one of them, I should put more of them up on YouTube, but you can go to my website, justmyname.com, and there's links to this. But I took a picture of one of these incredibly loud pachinko parlors. But even in Yusahara, you know, three times a day, they have these incredibly loud loudspeakers go off. The idea was originally that this would be a way to set off an alarm for a natural disaster such as an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got the capacity, so they do it every single day. So every morning I was startled awake at, I think it was 6 a.m., by a very loud version of Blue, Blue, My World is Blue. Do you remember this horrendous song?
No.
goes da 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 da. I felt like I said in the book, like I was in the movie Groundhog Day.
I do remember you saying that.
Waking up to this horrible sound every
yeah.
morning
oh, dear.
In this beautiful place.
Speaking of the cultural aspects, I was just going to mention that you saw on, I think it was just on the street one day, and I'm not sure what city this was in, you saw the annual Shinto Kagura play on the street, which is an ancient spring rite.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't on the street.
Oh, okay.
When I got to Yusahara, it happened that 2 hours after we got there, they were having their annual Kagura play, which is an ancient Shinto ritual where there's a demon, and he gets into fights with farmers, and the thing lasts like 8 hours if they do the whole thing. They were doing a truncated version of a mere 2 hours, and it's nice. It's to guarantee a good harvest,
mm-hmm.
is the idea. So mm-hmm. it was rice planting time in May when I was there, and they were about to plant their rice. So this was their annual thing. I was taken aback, however, because part of the play is that this really terrifying demon with a big mask and very aggressive, you know, moving jerkily around, he goes into the audience and he grabs, you know, like a two-year-old and swings them around. And you can imagine what this does to a two-year-old who doesn't know what's going on. So the poor kid is crying and terrified, and the mother is laughing nervously, and this is all supposed to be, you know, good fun.
Yeah.
I thought it was awful.
Yeah, in reading the book, I thought it was awful, too, and then I started thinking, like, do we have anything like that? And the only thing I could come up with was handing your child over to Santa Claus when he doesn't want to go.
Yeah, but at least Santa Claus isn't supposedly, I mean, well, we do have the thing about you better watch out, you better not cry.
Right.
But no, I mean, it's pretty awful.
Yeah, no, it sounded more scary.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about Toyota City, if you can talk about your experience of going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from Yusahara, I went to Toyota City, which is where Toyota makes its cars, most
mm-hmm.
of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by far the largest industry in Japan. And they rolled out the red carpet for me.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't have been nicer, and they took me to a great lunch and a great dinner. And their main PR guy had grown up in California. He's Japanese, but he grew up most of his childhood there. So he spoke perfect English.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally found out why they were rolling the red carpet out. It was because of the problems with Toyota being accused of having runaway cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first American journalist to visit there since then, and they wanted to convey the message that they weren't this evil company. And as a matter of fact, he was very convincing that their cars, they could never figure out what the problem was, and either a lot of people were trying to take advantage of it, you know, by saying that their car had run away when it hadn't, or they admitted that there was a problem with the foot pads could bunch up underneath the gas thing and catch it or something. But aside from that, they insisted there really had been nothing the matter with it. And I was impressed, you know, they were rolling out their new hybrid car. They had a hydrogen car that they insisted was going to be worthwhile. As I said, I am extremely skeptical of hydrogen vehicles.
Yeah.
They were telling me that they thought that the larger vehicles, such as trucks or buses, could be run with hydrogen. But there's, you know, if they get down to costing a mere $100,000 each, that will be cheap.
Mm-hmm.
they cost a huge amount of money. And producing the hydrogen doesn't make any sense. But to me, electric cars do make sense. And they had they were instituting a smart grid there. There are four places in Japan that are doing various kinds of smart grids, but they don't really have a national program, which they should. And TEPCO doesn't want to do this. They don't want to have to accept power back from consumers. It's not clear what's going to happen after these test projects go. But they took me to a model home where, ironically, there was a Nissan Leaf plugged in.
Oh, wow.
Not a Toyota. The idea, they showed me a very slick video they'd made of what's supposed to happen in the future where you can monitor the amount of electricity your home is using, and you can decide that you don't want to drive your car. You want to put electricity back from your car battery into your system that day, things like that. The thing I didn't like was that the electric companies, I think, are taking advantage of this to try to do all-electric homes. So one of the things I found was that solar hot water, which I just installed in my house here in Vermont, is not being pushed at all in Japan. Instead, they're pushing, you know, sort of energy-efficient electric hot water heaters, and they are more efficient than ours, but on the other hand, they're using a lot of electricity that they could be avoiding by using solar hot water. So the solar hot water people have made sort of a devil's bargain with the gas company.
Oh, wow.
to promote people using natural gas and solar hot water on their roofs. But this is another, I mean, this is a wacky thing I discovered. Back during the energy crises of the 1970s, following that, a lot of people in Japan put up solar hot water on their roofs. And because it's a temperate climate, most places they didn't have to worry about whether the water was going to freeze, mm-hmm. like we do here. So they didn't need to have antifreeze in their pipes. And consequently, they didn't need to pump it. They could actually put a tank of water on their roof, the cheaper versions of this, mm-hmm. and it would work just by regular gravity. Some unscrupulous salesmen went around and saw the tanks on people's roofs and told them that they had to sell them these expensive chemicals to put in them to make them work correctly, which wasn't true.
Oh, wow.
So they got a bad reputation, and they have maintained that. So now they have a bad image. If you have solar hot water, it means you're stupid or that you're poor. And so they have a low-class image, and very, very few people have them, even though it's the oldest and most proven renewable energy that we've got out there.
I'm curious, in sort of having done this, it was a six-week trip, and studying and researching pretty deeply into renewable energy and the Japanese situation, I'm wondering how you felt coming home about the United States and our own situation with renewable energy.
Well, I think we're a little bit ahead of Japan, but not that far. Vermont had the first feed-in tariff legislation for a state
yeah.
in the country, and that was only a few years ago. So Vermont is fairly far ahead in some ways. On the other hand, I'm very distressed by the huge fight that we're having over wind power, and I'm sure some of your listeners will disagree with me, but it's mostly a matter of not in my backyard kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, in Japan they have the same thing, only more so. There's a lot of concern in Japan over health issues pertaining to large wind turbines. And from what I can see, there's no evidence, no compelling evidence other than anecdotal stories that they do cause any health problems. So I'm a proponent of wind turbines. There's a great deal of concern in Japan and here that wind turbines could cause dizziness and a variety of other problems. I have seen no convincing epidemiological studies to support this idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everything that you do, there's going to be a give and take, right?
Right.
So geothermal energy is something that I think we should be looking at here more in the United States, the kind where you have closed-loop systems, where you drill down, and that's used very sparingly in Vermont, but for particularly for new construction, I think we could look much more into that. We certainly are using a lot more solar panels and solar hot water, as I just installed. But I think we and we're far, far ahead of the Japanese in terms of efficiency Vermont, in terms of trying to make our homes more energy efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese homes are notoriously poorly constructed, poorly insulated, really, really lamentable state of affairs over there.
Did you have any sense of why?
Well, again, it's sort of a long story, but traditional Japanese homes were actually... I went to Kyoto, which is another one of the eco-model cities, and they have traditional homes called machiya, which I have a picture of them, and they don't look like a whole lot of anything, but they're right next to each other, so they're insulated from both sides, and they have a natural flow through the household during the summer.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to the Tokyo Edo Museum in Tokyo, where they showed some of these older homes. And in Yokohama, I also went to a place that had a lot of the older homes, a garden. And they were pretty well insulated, sort of mud and straw construction.
Mm-hmm.
But after World War II, nobody wanted any of that old stuff. In Japan, what they mostly worried about in the summer was it being too hot.
Right.
So they worried about natural convection. The winters they just lived through, except for the northern island of Hokkaido, where it's more like Vermont and it's cold. But in most areas in Japan, it's relatively temperate. So they would have little hibachi stoves, and they would huddle around them all
right.
in one room
yeah.
in the winter. And then when they wanted to be, quote, modern and have central heating, it became a problem because they didn't really have homes that were well insulated. They didn't have double pane windows.
Okay.
They haven't passed any legislation to do that. Japan is quite famous, rightly so, for being efficient with its businesses. Following the energy crisis of the 70s, they passed a lot of legislation to encourage businesses to be energy efficient, but they haven't done it with their homes yet, and they need to.
Okay. So, Mark, I'm just curious, where are you marketing your book? Where are people able to find it?
They can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble online.
Okay.
And that's the only place they can find it. I've done 4 books with major New York publishers and one of them with a smaller Vermont publisher. But this one I decided just to do on my own because the technology has become simple to do that with.
Yep.
A book on demand. So first I brought it, and I was in a big hurry because it's a timely subject.
Sure, yep.
And in order to try to get a book contract and then have it published a year later, it would have taken a long time. So I decided, well, I'm just going to put this out myself. So I did, and it's a very nice little book.
So you put it out as a print book as well as an e-book?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's available as an e-book that you can buy through Amazon or wherever, and it's also a paperback. So if I can push myself a little bit,
sure.
The e-book is only $3 or so, and the paperback is only $10. It's a fascinating look into a different culture, but it's also a real call to action, not only for the Japanese, but for the rest of the world, because we're facing a real problem with climate change, and we are going to run out of fossil fuel. Right now, I think people aren't worrying about it so much because we're fracking for natural gas and making that a little bit cheaper. It's buying us time at the cost of the destruction of the environment, and I think it's the wrong way to go.
Well, this has been very interesting. I enjoyed the book. It's called Japan's Tipping Point. Crucial Choices in the Post-Fukushima World by Mark Pendergrast. And your website is markpendergrast.com?
That's right.
So thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thanks a lot.
That again was a conversation with Mark Pendergrast. And as I just said when I was speaking to him, you can read more about his work at his website, markpendergrast.com. Inspired by our guest Mark Pendergrast's interest in Japan, this week's Write the Book prompt is to fold an origami crane. If you get stuck in your writing or are simply wanting an activity that keeps you thinking but not struggling, folding an origami animal might help. You'll still be engaged in a creative act, but you'll be following a set list of instructions which might free the author in you to continue working away from the computer keyboard. A friend of mine told me this was a kind of weak prompt, so I went online to look, and I am not the first person who thinks that folding an origami animal might help you break through that writer's block. Anyway, I will offer a few links on the podcast site this week to origami paper folding sites, and you can also print the Write the Book logo that I'll put up on the site for colorful folding paper. Or you can use a sheet from your recycle bin. Maybe a rejected poem or scene can have a second life as a crane, a frog, or a flower. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And do remember that this station is here thanks fully to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. So this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.